improve the shelters and make it better and better. Anitra Freeman keeps saying, but what about the tent city? What about the tent city? What about the tent city? I'd like to point out also to what Ibrahim says about the missions, right? A lot of that critique that comes from us from the missions, right, is not our own critique. It's media fueled, because if the press is running it, everybody saying, excuse me, why aren't you in the mission? Like this, people are going to come with some variation like it blows dog, right? Do you know what I mean? It sucks, right? Something like that. So the critique of the missions, like, we have to be a little careful because, you know, they're part of the continuum of care and we're not supposed to criticize them. And the money question, where all the money goes, we're never supposed to ask, right?
Because they
view us as clients and consumers of their service. And a lot of us view ourselves as a commodity and a resource to keep people housed, right? You know? So there's a difference. So that's very impolite. That's a very rude question to ask, right, about the money. But, you know, where did the $270 million go in the 7 years after the shelter reconfiguration scheme go, right? While the homeless problem got bigger and bigger, and now there's no room at the inn. That's what I kind of wonder, but that's a very rude question. You're not supposed to ask that, that it went into like wages and salaries and stuff like this, and
shame,
into food stamps, and
shame,
but that's the way it is, you know? They got some people making the six... I'm sorry.
Well, no, I just was sort of interested. There are two other active tent cities here. I'm hoping that we can get some presentations.
Yeah, and some more from other people.
And then maybe take more questions.
Yeah, we want to get to
Seattle and Isla Vista.
That's good.
Our active tent cities.
That's
I'd love to hear from them as well.
Who's moderating?
I'm sorry,
who's moderating?
Yeah, I got a statement. I got a little bit of food for thought.
Yeah.
This is just a little bit of food for thought. You call them tent cities.
This is Cliff.
What if we start calling them tent neighborhoods and demand the same rights and privileges as any other American neighborhood? The only difference is we're in a tent and not a house. They can't come in and search our tent without a search warrant, blah, blah, blah. We're allowed to drink in our tent like they do in their homes. Homeless neighborhoods. Just a food for thought.
Well, one of the things that got us active is we have the drug.
We're supposed to have the drug and alcohol-free facility, because that's what they think about homeless people.
Well,
you're in dress clothes with a wine bottle on your palms up saying, give me, so I can get drunk again. So if we could come across that. That's such a stereotypic, imperialistic idea to keep people down and to keep people up looking down on you, that we're not that way. Even though some of us have those problems, some of them have them also. So we got to come across that we're trying to do well for ourselves, which we are.
So I renew my request to focus specifically on the operations of the active camp, so we can at least get that all.
We're asked earlier. He doesn't want to be recorded.
Oh.
The seven churches, and I don't want to be taped.
Oh, you don't? Okay.
Camp Paradise was around
for almost
a year by the time I came on the scene, and I moved into the neighborhood, my neighbor is a person I work with the Green Party a lot, and he invited me to go down to the camp, and I was just really impressed by how people had just come together and said, we're organizing ourselves, you know, screw the system, we're organizing ourselves, and that was really inspiring to me. And also that there were neighbors who were saying, wow, what this camp is doing is better than it was before. So in terms of cleaning up the drug dealing that was going on and physically cleaning up the area. And so I was getting this message that instead of no in my backyard, which we keep hearing, that this was a yes in my backyard kind of thing. People were seeing the advantages of having a camp there. However, there was this sort of constant threat that, oh, the police are going to come and roust us, you know, any day. And this sort of living under that sort of anxiety was screwing with people's way of life and being able to be comfortable there. Even though people felt like this was home, like they weren't homeless,
really. They just didn't have a conventional house. But they had created a family and support each other and keeping off of drugs and alcohol. And so it was, they had a garden, a fish pond, and all this stuff. So I got to thinking, you know, what could I do to support this group? And I'm part of a group called the Community Housing Land Trust of Santa Cruz County, which basically is set up to acquire land and lease the housing that is, and actually lease the land, and people actually own their homes. So I got to thinking, how could we take that process with Camp Paradise and basically be the organization that deals with the city to take control of the land, and basically the people camping, we just allow the people to camp there. And there was a TV show, a community TV show, where there was talk about Camp Paradise, and a couple of city council members were on there. And one of them says, well, if a community nonprofit would step in and be a go-between in this situation, that I would look at that and support that. So I got up on TV and said, well, I've been working this out with my organization. And so there became a public process of how the city would work with my organization to allow Camp Paradise to become legal.
Politically, it
may seem
politically happier to think that your nonprofit would kind of manage
to
take legal responsibility for the
camp. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So the city was attracted to that concept, that a nonprofit would take responsibility for the group. So there was public debate, and we had some unanimous votes to keep going and talking about this process. And for a while, there was a good month there where it was basically understood that the police were not going to come in because this process was going on. So it was a real relief for a lot of the campers for a while. Trying to think of where the next step is on that. But anyways, without going into a long story, what happened is that my organization decided not to do that, backed off. But in the meantime, there's another organization that came in called the United Services Agency, which is headed by a man who had started a lot of homeless services in the county, named Paul Lee. And actually, he stepped in, and they decided, you know, if I would be the one coordinating it, that we could go along with that process. And then there were city council members starting to propose things like that the camp could move to another area, because they didn't like being by the river, which is where it was, and sort of being in a sensitive ecological area and that kind of thing. So we were looking at other pieces of public land, and actually there was one city council member that was looking at the documents that the city had put together for Dignity Village and seeing how can we adapt this to Santa Cruz, and I was working with him on that. And then somewhere along in this process, a flood came and washed the camp out.
They opened the gate.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's debate on whether that was deliberate or not, and it seems pretty unlikely that it was just a natural thing. I mean, you don't have a flood like that. But anyways, the city did take somewhat of responsibility by paying for 2 weeks of hotel stay for everyone. Yeah, which was not really enough, and this guy Paul Lee put in some money for it too.
But it was Christmas time.
It was right around Christmas. And also another thing that happened in the midst of this is the city offered us a house to use as a headquarters, a house that they own, which is going to be torn down eventually to make way for a family shelter, for the homeless services center. So it's like a temporary thing. Yeah, this, the stipulation is that nobody can stay there.
Where?
And, yeah, right. Well, I mean, there was a point that you know, we were staying at a state park for a while, which is limited stay. We can only stay there for three days. And so that ran out, and it was dead of winter. It was cold, and people were staying in the house, and the city got word of it, and they were going to cancel our lease. So in the midst of that, one of the people who was part of the board of this umbrella nonprofit that's helping us out, is the former pastor of a church, the Mount Calvary Lutheran Church, and he volunteered to pave the way for the group to stay there just on an overnight basis, like show up at 10, leave at 9, and like it was better than, you know, bucking the city on the house and all that kind of stuff. Or just going out and creating a campground. So as they started being there, they volunteered to cut the lawn and do some landscaping and fix the place up. And in the process, the congregation got to going, wow, these people are great. They're helping out, cleaning up. And they said, well, you can stay as long as you want. And so, but there could only be as many as 12 people. And so it was just a limited amount of people because they didn't want it to get out of hand. Like they'd had a campground there before and it kept growing and growing and growing. And that's sort of the way Camp Paradise was. It grew as many as 50 to 60 people and it would really fluctuate. So in addition, they started going out to the neighbors and saying, you know, if you'd like, we could take care of your yard. We'll clean it up. And I've started getting, I went down to the flea market with Larry one day and bought a whole bunch of landscaping equipment, like lawnmower and blowers and chipper and all this stuff. And so now they've got landscaping contracts all through the neighborhood. Yeah. So the idea is, with the Service Corps, is that to sort of turn it around and say, we're not just forcing ourselves on a community, we want to be an asset in the community. And that to, and so like what people say are worried about what an impact this is going to have on the community and that like it's going to be a drop in property values and that kind of thing, we can say, hey, look at this. We're improving the area. and being a community resource, we're having kids from the neighborhood coming in and Dirt Cloud is teaching them bike repair. You know, stuff like that. And we're planning on doing a cleanup in the neighborhood of just some sort of public areas. So saying that, you know, this is an asset to the community.
We have an ongoing service.
Right. And we've been... We went through a big public process of the city. We wanted them to open up public land for us to camp on a more permanent basis. And what came out of that is like a baby step, which is that they amended the camping ordinance to allow for camping in 3 city parks for up to 15 people for no longer than 2 weeks. Yeah, right. So, and I mean, of course, it's not a permanent solution. It's like, you know,
$1 million liability.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've already got that.
What is that? Uh-huh.
Exactly the win. Okay. It's 3 city parks. Camping for up to 2 weeks, for up to 15 people. Right. Okay. And it also goes along with, it needs to be connected with some sort of ecological restoration project. And so we're in the process of negotiating how much work that is involved and that kind of thing.
Oh,
yeah, an in-kind service. So it's to go along.
We're on very limited time.
Right.
One more presentation.
Okay. So I just wanted to make one more comment, and sort of along the lines of the workshop that I was envisioning, and I'm really glad to be part of this one, is that what I'm envisioning it is that these homeless camps are seen as a way to like challenge the corporate slave mentality. But here we are coming together, providing for ourselves, using the little resources and living as lightly on the planet as we can, and being a force of unity and coming together in the community.
Well, we got all the time.
So if we can do that up and down the west.
Yes.
Let's do it. Go, Chris, over.
After our lunch, you know, my hope that I put on the piece of paper is that people from the different camps get together and share how they do things, like children and people who aren't pulling their weight, you know, and sanitation facilities and that kind of stuff. That's what I'm hoping. And if you guys are interested in it, here, if you can tell all the people in your camp who are here, maybe get some folks together just to share how we deal with those structural things day to day. That's all.
Interesting. Isla Vista is an unincorporated area which you can have. We don't have a city council. And we found ourselves in a position where we were negotiating with the park district, which is the only governing body in our area. It makes things a little difficult, but it's also positive because these people are more integrated into the community. They're not like your normal politician. So we actually found ourselves, after I was explaining a little bit, after they found out that the sleeping ban didn't apply to the parks, we found ourselves in a position where we could try to go to the park district and actually allow them to open up all the parks to camping or sleeping. We were initially negotiating down to only 3 parks because in terms of our local community, there's only about 20 people or 30 people maybe that are actually like living on the street. There are people in their cars. But we found out that this doesn't comply with zoning regulations, which would, you know, involve a conditional use permit for this land. So it was either open up all the parks or open up no parks. And, you know, there were a lot of fears that I talked about, you know, influx of people coming into town, and there were a few incidents that happened right before the vote that worked against us. But also, we're working in a situation where there's no shelters in our town, so all the court cases that, you know, are brought up about sleeping are thrown out of court. So, basically, the county is meeting with us right now. We just had our first meeting last week, and, you know, there's a lot of big wigs in the county government that are trying to find a resolution to, like, what we're doing. And the question I asked about the shelters is because I have a feeling that, you know, after they go back through their research on the possibilities of, you know, the tent city, they're going to offer a shelter, they're going to offer some compromise, and we're adamantly, like, against that because the people don't support that. And so we called what we're doing to a certain extent like an outdoor shelter to kind of frame it within like third language. And, you know, it'd be totally like independently run through a nonprofit organization, and it would be self-contained, self-governed, and we would limit it to, you know, locals first and have a few openings for like, influx, because there are, you know, good people that do come in and good people that leave. But I would like to open it up to questions because I don't want to just go on if I'm not addressing what people want to hear.
No, go. You're doing good.
Okay. Is there anything anyone wants me to speak to?
He has a question.
Yeah, the deportation.
And that was a selection from the encampment workshop. Or is it the empowerment workshop? A little of both. I think a number of workshops got melded together last Saturday at the Right to Sleep Summit, which we'll be picking up on Sunday when the show returns. We have a call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert North. This is the Ray Glockernick, and I'm sitting next to Chris Fredrickson, and I understand that you wanted to interview one or both of us.
This is true.
And is this a good time for that?
Sure, why not?
Which would you like to begin with?
Well, why don't we do a little of both of you? Heck, I mean, you guys haven't been listening to the show, I take it.
Chris was listening for a bit.
Oh, okay.
But actually, we're only in a situation where you can hook up with one phone right now.
Okay, well, since
so roughly one at a time.
Well, we have you first.
Okay.
Now, I should introduce you. You are Ray Glock-Grunike. You are a former attorney, as now a legal worker, and a candidate for the Green Party's, which latest legislative district?
Well, actually, I'm the Green Party nominee for United States Congress, 17th District.
There we go. Thank you.
That's the one where Sam Farr is the incumbent. It's Monterey County, San Bernardino County, about half of Santa Cruz County.
Well, anybody but Farr, that's my, well, not anybody, but certainly we could do better than Farr. But I first met you, 25 years ago or more, actually.
1977.
Correct. Scott Creek Bluff, you were the attorney of record for a sort of an early Camp Paradise effort on wheels.
Right.
And you want to talk a little bit about that, or?
Well, that was my first involvement with homeless issues. And basically, it was a fascinating and very colorful series of events in which a squatter's village ended up having a war with the sheriff's department. And there were, and it was a war, and much of that war got fought out in the courts, and I was the attorney for the part that did get fought out in the courts.
Wasn't it rather the sheriff's department that declared war on the squatter's village?
Well, it's a little bit like Israel and Palestine. They were volley shot anyways. Would you like me to recapitulate a little bit how it started?
Well, sure.
It's a very funny story.
I would certainly want to hear it, but I wasn't aware that the squatters ever invaded the sheriff's department in order to take over their, you know, to seize their homes or
to tow away
their vehicles.
Actually, they didn't seize the homes of the sheriff's office, but it actually started with the flattening of all four tires of a sheriff's vehicle.
Oh, I see.
Which some people might consider an attack on the sheriff's department.
Well, can we go back a little further? And wasn't there, in fact, sort of a exponential rise in the harassment of people in vehicles in Santa Cruz over the mid-70s, documented by Tom Noddy and Andy Luff?
No, actually, let me give my version of it.
Sure, please, go ahead.
During the mid-70s, you had a sporadic enforcement of the camping laws. And in those days, the county was as difficult and rigid as the city was. And so the primary focus of the Scott Creek struggles were around the, were in connection with the sheriff's department and county ordinances rather than the city, although the city did become involved as well. And what happened is that you had enforcement, which varied considerably. In other words, there were some cops that were horrible, there were other cops that were fine, they looked the other way, etc. And it was, for the most part, before the episode with Scott's Creek began, it was not a systematic thing, but it varied. Now, for example, Tom Noddy became involved in an engagement in the city with actually Officer Andy, I'm forgetting his name.
Crane, perhaps?
Andy Crane. Mm-hmm. Andy Crane. And he ticketed Tom Noddy's vehicle, which was an old colorful old hippie van called Vandorf, and he declined to ticket the one sitting right next to him, which was the Winnebago. And the part of the irony is that as that came across was that Crane had acknowledged the discrimination, was blissfully unaware that such discrimination on the basis of wealth was in any way improper or illegal. He just thought that it was appropriate to go ahead and hassle poor people or counterculture people and to leave good middle class campers alone,
mm-hmm.
Even when they're doing identical conduct. There was almost an innocence to Crane's discrimination that, of course, cops should be treating the poor and the rich differently.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, but there wasn't a high-level thing until Scott's Creek. And so what happened, and the way it fit in, is that the good cops, and there were several who would be more humane, what they would do, if you happen to have a good cop, it was typically, from the good cops, it would be enforcement on a complaint basis only. And oftentimes the better cops would say, hey, you know, you can't park here, but you know, be cool about it. We don't have to arrest you or cite you or anything. Be cool about it. And there's this place where nobody will hassle you, and that's Scott's Creek. And the good cops were actually directing people to the Scott's Creek Bluff area, which was up toward Davenport. And of course, it also had the benefit of, on the part of the good cops, it was a little bit self-serving because it was getting people out of the city jurisdiction and into the county jurisdiction. So, but much of it was probably fairly benign. So the point is that with the assistance of the cops, Scott Creek grew by leaps and bounds, and it became the appropriate place for people who did not want to get hassled by the cops to go to, and you could feel secure there. And the landowner of Scott Creek really didn't care. They were fine by having these people, and since, on the whole, enforcement was on a complaints-only basis, and the landowner didn't care, Scott's Creek was the place to go, and they built up quite a little community there. And as any is true of any community, you had a variety of personalities, and some worked, and some didn't. I mean, some folks got along with each other, and some folks didn't. Some weren't.
You had children.
You had one child being born on Scott's Creek Bluff. Peaches. Later, a folk song was written about her by Andy Ackerley, who's a fine singer and songwriter, and who was also at that time Tom Noddy's girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And so, it was kind of an idea.
Looks like we lost. Lost our interviewer, our interviewee, but he'll be back.
So you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3. That was Ray Glock Gruneich, who's been doing a lot of legal work around, I guess, capital punishment, and has recently signed on again to, he's going to be helping me under the supervision of attorney Chris Fredrickson with my blocking the sidewalk case. What is that? Well, you can read about it in the Good Times. They actually printed my letter. There's a reference to it in the issue Good Times just came out today.
You're on Free Radio.
Yes, you're the same guy.
No, we don't allow two-time callers, particularly two-timers.
Especially folks who try to correct you on history.
I'm gonna kind of bring you up to date. First of all,
I just want to say that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The transition was is that there was this incident in which, and it's a very funny incident.
The air was let out of the tires of a sheriff's vehicle.
Right, and it was a very funny incident, but what it did is it changed the whole nature of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And so instead of Scott's Creek being the cool place where everybody could go to, because the people of Scott's Creek did, and some would think with provocation, but I think fairly it wasn't major provocation, there was an arrest of one of the members on a valid reason, and they went ahead and flattened the air out of the tires of the cop car, of the sheriff's car. And what happened then is the sheriff's department then did declare war on the Scott's Creek community, and they went to the owner and made it clear to the owner that if he did not cooperate with the sheriff's war on the people that he felt fine about, that none of his property anywhere, not just Scott's Creek, but anywhere of his extensive holdings, would thereafter be protected by the sheriff's department. It was basically blackmail.
What was his reaction?
Oh, of course. Choosing between poor people and the security of his property, he decided to cooperate with the sheriff's office.
So in mid-December, the sheriffs came and essentially hauled away all the vehicles in 1977, right?
Essentially so. And what happened is that they had a spree, a cop melee, I would say, and they smashed all the children's Christmas toys and acted as out-of-control cops will act.
And they tried actually to seize the film that people were taking of it. I remember Linda LeMaster, who was out there, reported a reporter for the now-defunct, I guess it's The Independent or some such weekly, was trying to get away with film, and he had to outrun the police because they weren't...
It was a police melee. The police were doing all kinds of illegal
right.
things. I mentioned some of the things because it has a sentimental thing of, you know, actually going in and smashing all the Christmas toys of the kids.
Right. Did the police ever suffer a civil lawsuit that was effective, or did that never happen?
We filed a lawsuit, and yours truly didn't finish following through on it. But we did get some recovery for some folks. For example, we got Well, the sheriff's office never had to pay. One of the towing companies that had cooperated with the sheriff's office ended up having to pay big time. But they had to pay for...
North County Tow, perhaps?
I don't remember if that was the one or not that paid. I think they did. I think it was.
So a lot of vehicles were towed, and people's homes, in essence, were towed.
And without exception, every man, woman, and child that was hauled away in that situation became ill. The war was effective at the psychological level as well as at a physical level, so that it was so dejecting to go from a position of, we have a happy community here, this works, we're cooperating with the sheriffs, and to a position of just being totally the target of wanton police action.
What kind of illness, Ray?
Oh, minor things like colds, etc., but everybody got it right away. I mean, it's one of the things that's sort of like you have this healthy community, and then within 24 hours, everybody's literally sick.
Well, I remember meeting afterward in a kind of an emergency meeting at what was, the Socialist Party IWW headquarters of with Mike Zaharakis there and others, kind of a place where, I guess it's now SCAN headquarters. It was a printing press area for a long time, or was SCAN headquarters while SCAN had headquarters.
Well, as you may recall, actually, the Scott Creek people quickly found a new home, a rather short-lived home, but it was a new home of sorts.
Right.
Called the county building.
And that's true. They went to the county building.
And they decided to start having a live-in, and they started doing cooking inside the county building. They took advantage of the showers that were normally reserved for the sheriff's officers. And they basically took over good parts of the building, and then as you might expect, that after a couple of days of this, there were a new wave of arrests, and at this point, it wasn't just the campers, but the campers and the supporters, including the late Michael Zaharakis, who is a priest of the Mabizram Orthodox Church.
And, of course, this happened on Christmas Eve, is that right?
Or close to.
December 23rd, yeah.
December 22nd, I'm not sure which.
And this precipitated, 6 months later, the longest misdemeanor trial in Santa Cruz history, right?
Correct. That was one of nine trials that was scheduled. That was probably about the second or third trial. And it had nine co-defendants, 33 counts, and they, in the end, did not get a single count of guilty. There was one count of guilty on one guy for a short while, but there was a tragedy that happened that prevented him from coming back and testifying. His girlfriend was murdered.
Now, what kind of the charges people face were what, like trespass, things like that?
Trespass, resisting arrest, and the most heinous of all charges, the thing that is makes us shudder with dread when we even contemplate the horror of this crime, sleeping in a vehicle, camping in one's vehicle.
And so you were the...
It was a misdemeanor, by the way. It wasn't a mere infraction. It was a misdemeanor for which you could go to jail.
You were the sole defending attorney on this case?
Correct.
And I know that you had kind of interesting collective decisions with the campers. You had to kind of work out your strategy. I would
like, if I can, to go ahead and repeat the one sentence that essentially won that trial for us.
Go ahead.
It is a beautiful line. You have to understand the dynamics of this. You had a situation where the prosecution, which was ably fought by Kathy Mack, a very fine professional prosecutor, and she had spent over a week of tedious, boring testimony proving defendant by defendant, vehicle by vehicle, these people actually did the awful thing of living in their vehicles. And, she had testimony from various officers about laundering, about et cetera. It just went on and on and on how she meticulously proved this high crime. And it seemed like we were flat against the mat. I mean, how could we possibly show that we had lived there? So our first defendant was a woman by the name of Janelle Pyle, a tall woman with sort of an Ozark twang. And she got up on the stand, and I asked her, was she related to any of the defendants? And she points to Michael Sharp and says, yeah, Mick there, he's my old man. And I said, ma'am, what is your occupation? And she looked at the jury and she said in this delightful, definitive Ozark twang, bus wife. And when she said bus wife, the jury cracked up. It just dissipated into nothingness, a whole week of testimony, because she recapitulated all of their evidence and showed what it meant. This woman was a bus wife. And And there was no way the jury was willing to convict anybody of anything after that single word.
This was probably the largest instance of jury nullification I've ever heard of.
Correct. It was a beautiful sight to behold.
Wow. And I know then that I guess you then did a deal where they wanted to put you all on probation on the other charges.
You're right. That was not that case. We won that case, and they dared not. But there was a later case involving, now we're going to the county live-in,
right,
which had, the first one had 9 co-defendants, 33 mm-hmm. counts. This one had 17 co-defendants, only 1 count each. Mm-hmm. And this one had, in addition to campers, as I say, some various supporters, including Linda LeMaster, who you mentioned, who then had a different name. She was known by her former name of Linda Cunningham in
mm-hmm.
those days.
I remember.
And what happened is we had a, hopefully not going on too much length, but some of the stuff is very colorful. We were trying to work out various plea bargains, and at this point, I just want to say that early on, before Kathy Mack did the prosecution, we had a prosecutor who had the wonderful name, the absolutely symbolic name of Rich Powers. Now, I kid you not, that was the prosecutor's name.
Right.
And I remember this one instance in which he told me, he was a very kind of a volatile guy, very bright and at times personable, but he was very upset, and he was telling me, "We will smash you. You're only one attorney. We have the whole district attorney's office to pour into this case. We will smash you." And he was just absolutely livid when he was making this threat. Of course, something he forgot is that the whole district attorney's office has another case or two on its docket to deal with. And by the time we ended up going down the road a ways, and they went through the longest misdemeanor trial in history, by the time we got to the 17 defendant case, the DA's office was begging us to let off on the pressure. The DA's office couldn't take all the pressure anymore, and we were being unreasonable by forcing them to prosecute. I suggested they could drop it at any time. I couldn't guarantee we wouldn't do more civil disobedience, but they could drop it at any time. We weren't forcing the prosecution.
And now, let me ask, during the course of all this, had people been able to regain their vehicles, and were they in a community?
Yes.
Were they hiding out in different places?
No. It varied, but we were able to regain it. And there was other sheriff's harassment that occurred. I mean, for example, there's an invasion of my home by a then sheriff's officer, now on Capitola City Police, Mike Arroyo, who, I shouldn't say invasion, he came and threatened to invade illegally, and he was very intimidating and physically intimidating. And there were a number of things that happened. There were illegal actions against me by the city police as the attorney in retaliation to the fact I was doing this. I was framed on a minor charge. They tried to claim I had parked my vehicle against a red curb, but I was able to show by the red paint on my tire that it was a setup and that they had specifically painted it red so they could go ahead and have my car towed away. It was a lot of stuff like that that, you know, were constantly cops. But I want to get to this point on the deal because it showed some of the flavor of the time. The DA's office was literally begging to get out of this. They were giving us sweetheart deal offers, and by now, the Scott Creek people had the taste of blood, and they wanted to drive the DA's office to the ground. And they were refusing all these deals. They were saying, "No, we're going to go for it." So then Judge Kelsey, who's a very interesting judge, a man of much justice and injustice and mixtures that are known only to him.
Who is this again?
Bill Kelsey.
Oh, yes.
But there are times when, and this was one of the times when Bill Kelsey...
Killjoy Kelsey, as I call him?
Well, this is the time when he was really at his best. He announced one morning, and this is going to sound incredible to anybody who doesn't know Bill Kelsey, but he announced one morning that we're on some 8:30 or 9 o'clock calendar that morning. He said, "We're going to have a special proceeding today at 11 o'clock, and I'm ordering all the defendants and counsel to be present." And we're wondering, what's he talking about? What's he going to do? So we all show up at 11 o'clock in the morning, and first thing he does is he tells, after we're all in sight, he tells the bailiff to go lock the courtroom door. tells the clerk that she can leave and the reporter that she can leave. Then he brings out all these donuts, has us all gathered around in a circle, and he said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Everybody grab a donut. It's on the house. And I'm going to get to the bottom of this. You guys have been offered the most sweetheart deals possible, and you're still refusing it. I've got to find out why. What's happening? So he says, I want each of the defendants to come up to my face and tell me what happened, in their words. And he told the prosecutor, who is, I think, still Kathy Mack, and says, you can't use any of this material for prosecution. And he says, and you're going to tell me the truth, even if you have to call me a motherfucker to my face. This is, of course, all off the record.
Right.
So he's doing that. We had a marathon session. There were tears, there was truth-telling, there was confrontation, there was screaming. I mean, we got to the bottom of the guts of what happened. Finally, the people were so moved by the honesty and candor of the judge giving a human ear to this, to their grievances at last, that they promised him that they would do the following. Oh, they had earlier been adamant. They said that they would have a spaghetti feed that night at the La Viga Park, smoke a few joints, and then in a more mellow mood, try to figure out if they could come to terms with the sheriff's office and with the DA's office. And so he agreed, go do what you gotta do and come back to me, and I don't remember what the deadline was. And they came back with an offer. And the offer was this, is that they would agree to have the charges dropped and agree to a certain form of DA probation, very limited DA probation, in which they would agree for a period of 6 months not to have any civil disobedience. See, we weren't just letting them off the hook of dropping charges. We're threatening, at this point, we're threatening more civil disobedience until they change all the camping ordinances. They would promise not to have any civil disobedience on the specific topic of camping, reserving the right to do civil disobedience on any other topic in the world, but on the specific topic of camping or camping rights, if the sheriff's office cleaned up their act on a variety of abuses and harassment items, and that the sheriff's office would be put on what was called geek probation. Now, geek was a term that was used. These people were called themselves the Scott Creek Geeks, after the circus tradition of geek. That was pre-computer days when geek had a different meaning. And the DA's office was going to enforce them. We would first of all promise, if we thought there was any infraction on the part of the DA's office, on the part of the sheriff's of a minor point, we would go to the DA's office and they would bring the sheriff's office in line. And we ended up, actually it wasn't 6 months, it was 3 months. And so the defendants were put on DA probation, the sheriff's office was put on geek probation, enforced by the DA's office. The DA agreed, the DA went over to Sheriff Al Norton and said, this is what you are going to do. They laid the thumb down hard on him. Good old, and I think this is when Ardanna was DA. I don't think that, although I might be wrong, maybe that Chris Cottle was still DA at that point.
No, there was, Phil Henry was DA.
Phil Harry. You're right, it was Phil Harry. Thank you. And we had the quietest, most non-harassing summer in Santa Cruz history, thanks to geek probation. And that was, and thanks to Judge Kelsey and his blessings of the spaghetti feed and the joints and the donuts and the whole work.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a sort of a modern parallel here. There have been critics in the homeless community of Camp Paradise who have been concerned that, you know, Camp Paradise sort of got a sweetheart deal with the city, and that Camp Paradise is keeping a lower profile than it used to because it wants to maintain its good relationship and special relationship with the city. And in the past, it had spoken about, you know, a sleeping ban repeal for all homeless people, just as it sounds like, and I'm not clearly remembering this, the Scott Creek group was talking about attacking the camping ordinances in the county broadly. And by the way, the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz came in 3 months after your trial in September and October of 1978. So the actual camping laws in the city were better. Although, according to activist Tom Noddy, as I pointed out to you, and I guess you disagree with this, but his research with Andy Laufer was that the number of camping tickets increased exponentially, 75, 76, 77, to hundreds of tickets.
Well,
and that
that was based anecdotally, because actually Andy and Tom and I were working and consulting together on that research. In fact, that's how I met Tom Noddy, was, mm-hmm. and Andy actually both was in connection with doing that research. I was introduced to them by the late Carolyn Simons, who has been the representative of ACLU.
Right, but are you saying that his take on this, that it was that there were essentially 100 times as many tickets 2 years later as there were?
No, that's correct.
What happened is it
got politicized. And it particularly got politicized in the city because we ended up having a very vicious and brutal police department in the late 70s and early 80s in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, my city police might have even committed a murder at that point. It was there was much very, very serious brutality.
He was talking about the mid-70s. Are you also referring to the mid-70s?
No. You see, here's where I'm disagreeing. My understanding is that the difficulty, if we go back as far as the mid-70s, everything stepped up after the Scott Creek trial in the city
right.
police.
Well, earlier
it was a mixture of good cops and bad cops, and the bad cops were very, very bad. I mean, they were routinely going around and clubbing and beating up people. Seriously, they may have even murdered one person.
Right. Well, what I'm saying, Ray, just to cut.
And we had a very bad police administration.
To cut through this again, the history I've heard repeatedly is somewhat different than what you've done, but that's good. The different folks have different perspectives. You, for a decade and a half, took camping case after camping case. In fact, you announced.
Yeah, hundreds of them.
And you know, one of them was the Maurice Egan case, where you actually tried to challenge the constitutionality
right.
of the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban. I guess law with respect to vehicles, anyway.
Right.
And that one again failed because of.
I didn't follow up on that at the appeal level. I did a brilliant job at the trial level, and we got our conviction. He got a $4 fine, but because I didn't finish my appeal, Maurice Egan took a complaint to the state bar, and I got disbarred.
And then you took many, many cases of the campers who began to challenge.
By the way, those cases were done typically for free.
Yes, they were. We all remember you for that, which brings me to the last 10 minutes of the show.
And would you like to spend that talking to Chris?
No, we're going to talk to Chris at greater length on Sunday because we got you now. You became a real resource for folks, for campers in the early 90s. Jay Green, Pete Pascal,
right.
Linda Edwards.
In addition to campers, people who were involved in demonstrations on camping issues.
Right. Yeah, you defended me on different occasions.
That got thrown in too. In fact,
it could have been the real reason you were disbarred.
We did two or three misdemeanor trials in which you were in the dock.
We won them all.
On every one, by straight acquittal. It wasn't just hung jury.
That's correct.
So
now let's get up to the future and actually talk a bit about what's going on now and the kinds of things I've been jabbing you with when I've been passing you by and running into you. You have been for a number of years working as a legal helper,
a paralegal,
on capital punishment issues and perhaps other issues.
Right.
And you've also taken an interest in politics, as you said, running for Sam Farr's seat on the Green Party ticket.
Correct. Actually, I hope eventually that he'll run from me, but that's all right.
Yes. Well, who knows who's going to run from who? The concern I have, I don't know if you heard the show, but the history of the Green Party locally on civil rights for the homeless has been very checkered.
Correct.
And I know that some people in the Green Party, and they'll be coming back to this in, I guess, three days.
Well, let me say publicly on the radio station, I'm among those Greens, and there are many Greens, who were very disappointed in Tim Fitzmaurice. We were hoping both by reason of his his and others' campaign promises that they would be much better on camping issues, and then especially we were hoping that he as a Green would abide by the state Green platform and do his utmost to decriminalize sleep crimes. And as far as I'm concerned, and as far as many Greens in the local party are concerned, his performance fell far short of that.
That's a very diplomatic way of putting it, Mr. Green Party candidate.
I chose to be diplomatic, yeah.
Yeah, well, one of the problems I've had with the diplomats in the Green Party is that diplomacy isn't changing the behavior of the police and the behavior of the city attorney, and the behavior, I think, of law enforcement officials generally, including parks and rec officials, toward homeless and poor people. And what changes that, I'm thinking, is massive, strong protest, and that has to be certainly a part of the Green Party officials who are, or Green Party wannabes, unless they're using the Green Party for that same old tired dodge of electoral politics, which to me, of course, and to many of us, has little to do with the real issues that confront the community. It has more to do with putting particular people in office, running campaigns, doing the scan thing.
Okay, well, you're actually landing on the correct issue.
Thank you.
You're giving a different spin to it than I would give.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major, in fact, I'm unfortunately my son is waking up, so I may have to dodge this question, but I think it's an appropriate issue to raise it another week, and maybe another time we can go ahead and specifically talk about the Green Party.
Let's do that, because we only have...
Let me go ahead and name the issue, though.
Yeah.
The issue, as I see it, is should the Green Party be primarily a protest vehicle, or should it be primarily an electoral vehicle? And there is a real split on that issue, and you and I are on the opposite side of the fence on that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I would invite a serious dialogue on it, another program, because my son has just woken up and I need to tend to him.
Well, come to the Green Party Assembly meeting 4 o'clock, Loudon Nelson, this Saturday to help get an accountability process so that people like Fitzmaurice and yourself, if you get elected, actually are held accountable for these positions.
Well, actually... I can't promise you that that'll be an occasion for doing that because I haven't seen what the agenda is for that, so I don't want to mislead your...
I believe on the agenda, and I would invite you to come and check
it
out.
Okay, well, then you're more informed than I am. But it is a real difference of opinion between
right.
us, and it is an issue that should be discussed.
And we will be taking it up on a later show. We've been talking with Ray Glock Krunike. Thank you, Ray.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're reaching the end of the show, so for all of you excited callers, time to get on the line and call real fast, because we have about 5 minutes left, and when Uncle Dennis comes in here, you don't got no extra time, I'll tell you, you got to get your butt in gear, and that's coming right at us from the cream to the dregs next show on Free Radio. We are going to be returning on Sunday with lots more interviews. We got an interview from the Coalition on Homelessness, Chance Martin. Before he decided to stop giving me street sheets. That's another story. Good stuff from the summit conference that we had this weekend. And also we'll have some progress reports from Sacramento. Housing California is meeting there this week. And some homeless activists from SHOC, Sacramento Homelessness Organizing Committee, who are planning a rally this summer, mid-July, at the Capitol, in which they're going to push the reality that a law against sleep is a hate crime, and that the Governor Davis, cannot afford to support hate crimes. There's going to be a march, or let's call it a walk, depending on what you want to call it, from San Diego starting on May 20th to Sacramento, according to Santa Barbara activists Bob Hansen and Nancy McCready, who are organizing that, and we'll have more on this on Sunday and give you a progress report of how that's coming. Plus, on Sunday, I will be reading you the legal response that I and my attorneys have to the city's latest attempt to defend the right of a mayor to order people out of city council chambers for unpopular speech, for a gesture that he doesn't like, for essentially, in a matter of caprice, using the decorum rules as a way of punishing those whose speech city council people don't like. We'll be talking about the candidacy of Riot Act Rotkin on the front page of the Sentinel that I referred to briefly. A caller called in and asked what I thought of Rotkin, and I've talked about Rotkin at great length. Too much has been said about him and by him. He is, unfortunately, part of the political landscape. He is a one-time former socialist feminist who essentially caved into, I think, police and corporate interests long ago, and that he's been he's won some points for it in some quarters. I mean, he's a very intelligent and skilled fellow, and he has a horrible position on homeless laws. He's how he can masquerade as a liberal up at UCSC where he's an instructor, I just don't know. But that may be coming up. We got lots of stuff coming up. I'm going to be going into the Albany, not jury nullification, but necessity defense, which there was some concern at this summit conference that the necessity defense may be helpful in dealing with individual campers or individual homeless people who are sleeping, but can't really effectively defend a community such as Camp Paradise, because people will say, well, you can sleep, but you can't set up stoves and tents and so forth. That's not really a necessity. But in fact, in Albany, that was done, and individuals won the necessity defense. Of course, their camp was destroyed by the police and by the city authorities, so maybe it's an academic issue. But perhaps not, because if you win the criminal case, then maybe you can win the civil case, which is what I'm going to do with the Heil Krohn case, and that'll be coming up, as I said, in more detail on Sunday. Also, I invite you to come on Friday to Peace Day. That's a day which Susan Zeman and other peace activists have been regularly showing up for at Ocean and Water Streets, one of the main intersections in Santa Cruz, with signs asking that this horrible, repressive, constitution-shredding war be ended. And that starts at 5 o'clock tomorrow, runs usually till about 6:30 at Ocean and Water. Come on down. If you haven't got a sign, usually the folks there have signs. It's certainly worth going to, and I suggest that. Next Tuesday is City Council meeting. I don't have the agenda, but I will on Sunday. I do know that there will be a new member of the Citizens Police RARA Board, or the CPRB, Citizens Police Review Board, as they call it, chosen, but Kennedy has refused to name an appointee, so the entire council is going to be doing it under pressure from members of the CPRB who want the seventh member named, because some of them are under the illusion, or perhaps, who knows, justified hope that they can make some changes on the CPRB with that seventh member. I would be very surprised this could be done without a real organization in place, but hey, surprise me. I love it. CPRB itself has a meeting on Monday at 5:30. If you're interested, you can check that out. And I think we have the arrival of our next host. He'll be here. With some fine music. He is here. So I'm going to sign off and seg you into From the Cream to the Dregs with a little music, the song that I had hoped to play from Mike True called Sleepin'. So let's see if we can legalize that in Santa Cruz. What a concept. Thanks for being with us. Call 423-HUFF between times. And we'll talk again on Sunday.
Some folks, they get to sleep in the nighttime, up in the daytime, wide awake. Some folks, they work at night, and sleep right through the day. Some got to work it, oh, they get to dream their lives away. I said, sleeper, close your eyes and float down the street. Sleep, sleeper, don't you know life, she's just sweet dream, sweet dream. Say, put your worries on the bed, go back to sleeper, sleepy head. When too much be going on, I get no sleep sometimes. Feels like I'm losing control, I'm losing sleep, that's why. You got to make yourself unwind. Sleep without sleep sensing. That's